You are listening to Mining Stock Education, where you'll learn from the top leaders in the natural resource sector and uncover quality mining investment opportunities.
The biggest risk in life is that you don't know what you don't know. And you always have to operate under that assumption that there are things out there that can hurt you that you don't know about.
Welcome to Mining Stock Education. My name is Brian Lenny. Today with me, I have Samuel Pelez, CEO of Olive Resource Capital. Sam was formerly a portfolio manager at Galileo Global Equity Advisors and an analyst at US Global Investors. Today, you are going to hear Sam's view on opportunities in the resource sector, navigating risk, and some words on Olive Resource Capital. Sam, it's great to have you. Let's start with gold. The gold price has been up for a number of months, and it looks in the last, let's say, 4 weeks, 3 weeks, the equities are starting to follow. Is gold the place to be right now for investors?
It's funny that you asked that question, because that's the type of question I ask myself every day when I wake up. And this move in gold has been quite unusual in the sense that the stocks have trailed the commodity and not the other way around. That's typically not the case when you see real moves. It feels like the market is skeptical about this move in gold. But when you go back 12 months, 24 months, see what's going on around the world, it kind of makes a lot of sense. So from a fiscal monetary perspective, you know, Western countries and actually most countries around the world continue to spend the way they were doing during the pandemic. We're seeing tremendous deficits. That obviously is going to put pressure on the currencies. But I think the biggest and most defining underlying theme is this kind of like new bipolar world that we seem to find ourselves in. China is now undeniably, a dominant country. Perhaps not the biggest, not the most dominant, but certainly has carved its own space. And what that means is that, you know, because the U.S. is not the sole dominant force in the world, we're not going to do everything around the world with U.S. dollars, treasuries, etc. Now countries are going to start looking for alternatives. And the first and most basic one that has been used in the past, and it seems that it's getting some relevance again, is gold. So I am surprised by the extent of the move and how fast it's happened. But when I check back to my facts and what's happened over the last 2 years, it kind of makes a lot of sense.
Going back to what you said about possibly the lag in the equities being, you know, investors maybe not believing it. And I personally have been thinking about this a lot because it's sort of puzzled me too. And like, what are the reasons? What is actually pushing gold up? And so do you have an opinion on why the gold price has, in fact, like, I know you've touched on debt, you've touched on some of these things, but, you know, let's take war, for instance. You know, moves in the gold price we've seen in the past linked to war have been, you know, blips. You know, the gold price rallies up. Maybe the war doesn't necessarily go on or take on what people think it does, and the gold price comes back. So today, is this a matter of Middle East and Ukraine tensions, or is it based on fundamentals why that gold price is going up?
I do think that war is certainly a factor and a big one. I don't think that it's the main factor. So war is naturally inflationary. We've seen it's shocking, like this situation in Israel and Ukraine, like the type of budgets for military expenditure that we're seeing, it's unprecedented, like these numbers. So it will be inflationary. So that in a sense will have an effect on gold prices. We also have the safe haven status that also comes to prominence when you're talking about war and conflict. But I think the real underlying theme is the deglobalization of the world. We haven't seen anything like this since World War I or thereabouts, when the U.S. kind of rose to this dominant stage. It's been 100 years, give or take. So I think that is by far the biggest underlying theme. I don't know if that gets resolved in a year, in a decade. I have absolutely no idea. But I think what we can be comfortable about is that directionally, the move is in that direction.
What about, let's say, the Fed's interest rate policy pivot? You know, we've seen gold rise without a pivot in policy. And if you'd asked me 6 months ago, I would have said, oh, you probably need that to see a defined move. So what do you think? You know, we've seen strength in the gold price. We've seen the Fed sort of waver on if they're pivoting or how much they're going to pivot by. How much do you think the gold's price depends on a pivot moving forward or the lack of pivot?
And generally, in my investment views, I think people put way too much weight on a single individual and a 25 basis point decision and the dot plots, they're naturally important. But at this stage where we are today, I don't think that a 25 basis point move one way or another, or a delay in a rate hike, or it's that material. Because when you start, you know, you look at government deficits, there are multiple percentage points. A 25 basis point difference in the funding rate, it's extremely marginal when you're seeing that type of real expenditure. This is real money that's being printed and spent and delivered, you know, introduced to the market through all the transmission mechanisms. So I think it does have an effect, but I don't think it's as major as most people think. And actually, if you look at charts, they have decoupled in a way. We have real positive rates in the U.S. today. The U.S. dollar is actually rising, at least in the short term here, because even though the U.S. continues to spend like there's no tomorrow, the U.S. dollar is still among the better of the currencies, right? It's and we have a situation where real yields are positive, the U.S. dollar is rising, and gold is rising. That's why this is more unusual, and it points to a bigger and deeper transformation, rather than the typical sort of like mini cycles that we're used to reviewing and understanding and charting.
Okay, so there's opportunity in gold. So you're deploying money into the gold sector. Where is the opportunity? Is it in exploration, development, the producers, the royalty companies? Where do you see the opportunity?
There is opportunity across the ladder. Typically in these cycles, the movements happen differently. You know, you typically see the majors move first, and then it trickles down, higher risk. And then finally, at some point, we hope it gets to the explorers. Here in Canada, we have a big number of them, and they're not seeing much love. But I want to say there's opportunity everywhere. And in particular, I think, rising tide lifts all boats, but there's certainly going to be winners amongst those, and not to sort of like deviate from the main topic of gold rising, but you know, investing in the gold sector over the cycle hasn't proven to be a successful investment strategy. So you don't want to invest in the entire sector. You want to be selective in stocks that you pick, whether the gold price is rising or not. And I think that remains the case for this cycle. We are very micro driven. We find specific opportunities. We like companies with strong management. I think I'm going to say that many times over the course of the interview, because it kind of touches on every point. The sector that in particular that I'm most excited about is the sort of like small to mid tier producers, because we are due for consolidation. Some of them have exceptional operations. They're being valued like, you know, like they're going out of business almost. And there's going to be some very large surprises for investors coming out of some specific names in that single bracket.
Right. Okay, so let's go with the point of strong management. Is there anything in particular that you look for to say, okay, look, those guys are stronger than this group, or there's something, what stands out about a management team for you that attracts your attention?
There's two things. One is, you know, when you take over a company or you found a company, it's like a marriage. It's there for the long term. There'll be difficult times, and you have to have confidence that the person in charge is going to see it through no matter what. We've seen there's a revolving door in certain situations where CEOs come and go, and they show up in different places. But there is a select few that stick around, see it through, deliver on the promise, weather the storms, and that gives me great confidence. The second one is going back to the original point where we're talking about this new bipolar, deglobalized world. I think a lot of things are going to change. And you need that management team that's adaptable, that's going to understand the needs as the new problems arise. And that's not something that's easy to find. And somebody who gives you that confidence not to squander the opportunity or blow up the company because times are changing and you can't continue doing things the way you were doing them before. And I think that's a factor that's extremely underappreciated by the market. It's not just execution. It's also adaptability to the new challenges. Things are going to change. The way we monetize commodities, I think, is going to change dramatically. Not just gold, just in particular, the role of commodity traders, the role of distribution, the green premium in the sense, not of green, but the origin of the product. There's going to be more ways to extract value out of the chain. And I think the smarter management teams are going to be able to do that.
You know, some of those things that you talked about, are those things that, you know, you invest in the company based on its fundamentals, you put your money in, and then is it over time that you're learning how that specific management team deals with the ebbs and flows, and then you come to the opinion, hey, look, these guys are pretty strong because they've been able to deal with, you know, the ups and downs of the market. So is that an over a period of time that you're saying, okay, look, these guys are strong, their next deal, I'm going to support them in? Or can you necessarily look at past and say it's going to be prologue and you know, extrapolate out about a management team?
I think there's a handful of management teams that that you have that confidence that whatever they do next, you're going to be there for it. It's never a guarantee, but it's almost a guarantee. Like, there's serial success. You see that with fund managers as well, which is a space that I've studied a lot. There are a select few people who just can deliver year in, year out, this project, next project, this company, take it to production, sell it, start a new one. It's just some people just get it and they just do it. So yes, there is that carte blanche for some of them that you just believe anything they're going to do next. You know, they're reasonable and responsible people. They do take care of shareholder capital and their interests, and you can back them blindly. But I think the most exciting part is when you find a management team you've never met before, a new project, you start tracking it, you start seeing how they how they grow from somebody you didn't know, and they keep moving over to a person you come to admire. I think that's the most exciting part, is to be part of that process, especially if you're invested and you're making money. That makes it even sweeter.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. What about jurisdiction? You know, it's seemingly, I think you're right, that good people can seemingly make it work almost anywhere too. Does that apply to you? Like, will you back somebody that you believe in, even if it is necessarily in a tough jurisdiction? You know, there's parts of South America that have been extremely tough over the last, you know, probably 4 or 5 years. Conversely, Africa has been, you know, even a little bit longer of a history. So does jurisdiction matter to you as much?
The politically correct answer is yes. In practice, I'm going to say no, because, you know, Lundin Gold is a perfect example. Lundin Group and Ecuador, tangible example of completely taking something that was taken as effectively debt, you know, in a jurisdiction that was perceived to be difficult, and then look what they delivered. It's exemplary, and that has happened in other jurisdictions as well. So yes, jurisdiction is always a factor when you're investing, but I would say it's never a complete binary yes or no. You're just factoring into the investment scenario. Management plays a key role, naturally. And also the thing with jurisdiction is that these things are constantly changing, especially in these days in Africa, like Niger, Mali, Burkina, the political situation keeps changing pretty much by the day. So you can't make an investment decision today and say, okay, today it's good, and then it changes, and then it's not good anymore. I think it's always some shade of gray. It's something that you have to administer and manage. And it's, to be honest, I see it as a risk of doing business. You know, the deposits are set where they are. You don't get to move them or relocate them. And it's always just an arbitrage of risk and return. You take it into consideration and you make an investment decision. But yes, I would say it's never a binary yes or no for me.
Let's take a look at Argentina. You know, Milei's election last fall, and now he's in power, was quite a revelation for a lot of people. And to me personally, Argentina has gone from, you know, tremendous amount of risk to still a tremendous amount of risk, but I find myself being optimistic. How do you view Argentina? Is that opportunity?
So I was very excited to see the ascendance of Milei and his first days in office and just pushing reforms, in the first 100 days. I think we're over the honeymoon stage. Things are getting real now. I do think he wants to transform that economy, and resources can be one of the key elements, or have to be one of the key elements for that transformation. I am positive. I would caveat that by saying that Argentina is a federation, which means that every province has its own mining laws, their own mines ministry. So not every jurisdiction within Argentina is going to be equal. But there is some pretty exciting lithium projects that have gone into operation. That proves that it can be done. Like, these new projects can come into production. We've yet to see some of the crucial ones that have been stagnant for a decade or longer, in many cases much longer than that. See if we can unlock the value for those. Typically those, and I'm not an expert in Argentina, but my understanding is most of those are already in the balance sheet of larger companies. So we'll watch and see what they their investment decisions and what they decide to do. I have seen some of our more visible mining leaders in Canada traveling to Argentina and meet directly with the president. That's typically a good sign. Even Elon Musk was there recently, and we saw the pictures all over Twitter, X, etc. So I think the will is there, and that's the start. Let's see how that continues.
You touched on Ecuador, and obviously it's been a tumultuous probably decade there. With Fruta del Norte, being lost, Kinross, it was a huge loss for them, but it was an amazing pennies on the dollar investment by Lundin. And we've seen that, flourish. How do you view Ecuador right now? They've got a new president in, not along the same lines as Milei, but definitely, I would say, more pro-business and more conservative economically. Do you still see as much risk in Ecuador?
I do see risk in Ecuador. You have to remember a few years ago, I tried to relate because the president of Ecuador is about my age. And I think to myself, Jesus, what? This guy's got a big energy, let's say. But the U.S. used to have military bases in Ecuador. One of the previous presidents dismantled them, or effectively sent the Americans back. And ever since, that's become a release vault for organized crime in Latin America, predominantly drug trafficking. And that's a very lucrative business. And it can take over swaths of your economy very quickly. And my understanding is that that's what's taking place in Ecuador. And I don't think you can lead a transformation very quickly when that's the case. The appointment or the election of this new president, I think it's positive. He comes from a business-oriented community and family. So I'd like to watch and see how it evolves. I think projects like Fruta del Norte and the projects that are in production, especially those closer to the south of the country, are going to have a lot less impact. Maybe the ones closer to the north, which is closer to the drug trafficking area, they may have more issues, so with security, et cetera. But I wouldn't write on the jurisdiction as a whole. Like Argentina, I would say there will be pockets of areas where you can operate and where you can develop projects. Yes.
Getting back into the theme of gold or precious metals, in the last bull cycle, we saw kind of a push towards marginality, particularly on the M&A side of things, where the senior companies were buying up as many ounces in the ground that they could, expanding that sort of bank of ounces on their balance sheet. And, investors were sort of asking for it. And it sort of blew up in their face and what we kind of see today. But they've made a lot of progress. Do you see marginality, whether it's from the investor side or from the senior mining company side, being a theme in this next precious metals bull market?
I'd say initially, no. The current management teams at these companies, the majority of them, have nursed the companies through the leaner times. And those management teams tend to be a little more conservative. I think as the cycle gets warmer and warmer, you see some transition. And then a more aggressive manager CEO comes in, and then you get a lot more acquisitive and a little more growth oriented, because that's also what shareholders are asking about. But initially, when I go over the, you know, the top producers globally, I don't see, you know, Newmont has been in the serial acquirer, and now they're in the divesting of the secondary asset space. So I think they're going to try to be focused on their own portfolio. Barrick, likely to buy something, but Bristow has been very explicit about how that would look like. So I don't see marginality there. Agnico has been fantastic at doing acquisitions over the last few years, but more than that, just building up the resource of those assets they acquire. So they don't have a desperate need to buy anything. Although I think they may pull the trigger on things that they see like kind of fit their strategy. So I think at first glance, I don't see it. I think towards the latter part of the cycle, we may start to see that. And that'll be one of the indications that we are in the latter part of the cycle.
Right. Yeah. We're doomed to make the same mistakes. It seems as investors, it follows the same thing, right? We get caught up in the euphoria and make those same mistakes. You're talking about Agnico Eagle. Do you follow what's going on in Finland? There's Orion. We're going to talk about specific companies here. Orion Resources has a ROFR on their deal with B2 that was, oddly enough, acquired by Rupert. And Agnico is involved in the deal. It involves B2. What do you think of that deal? Do you have an opinion?
I was very excited to wake up the day that Orion announced that B2 had notified them about the Rupert approach, or the Rupert LOI or offer. I don't know the specifics of how it was presented, because the situation in Finland has been like a staring contest where everybody's sitting at the table, but nobody speaks up until Rupert finally decided to do something. And now everything is in flux, and there's going to be winners. Actually, I think there is a chance that if everybody plays their cards right, everybody's a winner, which is kind of a funny thing to say. You can't all be winners, but I think what this jurisdiction needs right now is consolidation and development. You know, if you can develop the Rupert asset over the line, over the property boundary into the Orion B2 ground, that would certainly facilitate a much bigger development. They'll be very positive for the industry. It's a pretty sizable resource in a great jurisdiction. Great economics. I think it'll be good for everybody in the space to see those type of assets develop, and for the capital in this juniors to finally find a way to be recycled into new opportunities. These guys have been around for quite a while. They've done a fantastic job making these discoveries. I think it's time for that to find a home, and then so we can recycle that capital back into the juniors, back into the space, and fund other new exciting opportunities.
You know, most of the, I think if you follow social media these days, there's so much talk about a crash, all the risk that's associated, the stuff we kind of started the conversation off with, you know, the risk with war, the risk with interest rates. What do you think is the biggest risk right now, and how are you navigating your portfolio or all of Resource Capital's portfolio to kind of, you know, take the best path towards making profit?
The biggest risk in life is that you don't know what you don't know. And you always have to operate under that assumption that there are things out there that can hurt you that you don't know about. The way we protect our portfolio is by, and this talks about the transformation that Olive has had since we took over, we've tried to reallocate the capital, a big portion, to the liquid markets. In the history of investment issuers, the problems typically arise when you go too deep into the illiquid market, and for some odd reason, the market just confabulates against you, always, at the worst possible time. You're completely illiquid, something bad happens, and you wipe out 30, 40, 50, 60, 80% of your asset value overnight. I see this as a long-term project. And I understand that by, you know, converting a big portion of our assets over time to liquid investments, we may leave a little bit of return on the table. But that will come at a substantially larger decline in risk over that period. And I think that's how long-term capital is built. You can't take every risk. You can't swing at every pitch. You have to be selective. We've elected to do it this way. That doesn't mean that we're not active in the more illiquid and risky speculative side of the market. We are, just to a lesser scale. I think this also gives us flexibility. There may be opportunities in the future where one of our investment companies is going through a bad time, and we're going to have liquidity to assist. And that's where you really get outsized returns, is when you have the liquidity available at the time of need. So this is, like I said, this is a long-term project. We're learning every day. We're building onto our knowledge base, and, you know, studying what other people have done to be successful. And I think, you know, I'm pretty happy with the opportunity that's in front of us. I'm not happy with what we've delivered to date. We spent a lot of time fixing. Now we start building. So I'm very excited about what's to come.
Just let's talk about recession. Recession, I think, is definitely been one of those topics that has driven the gold price, and in line with how it affects the interest rate policy. The talk of recession has been actually, I remember seeing the first stuff last year, and this recession seemingly, I guess it depends on how you define it, but seemingly has just not come. And so do you think that we will see a recession at some point this year? And if we do, how does that trickle down into the market? Is that broad-based a bad thing, or are we still going to see parts of the resource sector that are unaffected?
2024, it's a very political year. We had elections in Russia. We have elections in the EU Parliament. We have elections in India. We have elections in the US, naturally. And I can see and feel how that's permeating the market, just trying to keep everything on rails until all of these elections are over. You could argue that the US election in November is perhaps the most important one in a very long time, because it will define how this bipolar world may develop going forward. And I think politicians on both sides and all over the world are kind of working together to keep things in check. However, the degree of malinvestment that's taken place in particular since 2020 is astounding. And I think that's going to come back haunting people in the form of a very aggressive recession. I just wouldn't sign off on it happening this year. I think it's more likely it'll happen after the election, but you never know. You know, 2008 was we had a spectacular 2007, and then 2008 election year, everybody thought it was going to come, you know, be a clean year, and then you got the nasty surprise in October. So that could happen this year, but I just think the election is too important for the markets not to work together, the market participants not to work together to keep things kind of tidy. And the U.S. Treasury, they've been on the ball in terms of injecting liquidity into the market to continue the semblance that everything is okay. So I just don't see it as pressingly as other people suggest. But I do think there is going to be a recession in the horizon, just not as soon, perhaps, as other people are presenting it.
So let's go with the premise that it is going to happen, and let's not worry about when. So how does it affect something like net zero carbon emissions and that goal, and how that proliferates into the base metals, into the battery metals? How do they get affected? Because the reason why I ask is net zero seems to be more political these days than kind of a reflection of necessarily what the economy might be saying. So how do you see it?
It will certainly affect those plans. Those plans are not designed simply by politicians sitting in a dark room. There's obviously industry sitting in the room. They see an opportunity for government policy change to direct changes in their businesses. So I don't see the plans changing. I may agree with the statement, though, that it will delay plans. We're not going to get there by 2030. It's unrealistic. But I think those plans, you know, they sort of make sense. You know, if you don't have to, if you can build things more optimally for the environment, why wouldn't you? Now, the pressure of trying to deliver by a certain date makes absolutely no sense. It leads to malinvestment. We've seen that many places. I just think it'll take longer. But I think the transition is here to stay. And when I mean transition, you know, if you look at the universe of coal, coal is still very widely used all over the world. I think both India and China are consuming the peak amount of coal in their history this month or last month when it was still winter. So, you know, all of these things are here to stay. Coal is going to be here to stay. Oil and gas are here to stay. I think we're just building on top of that. The energy needs of our lifestyle today are exploding. And the subject of the year of AI is just computing on steroids. Like, you need so much power to get these things moving. Where is that power going to come from? I think, frankly, we're staring at a wall where we need everything. Coal, oil, nuclear, every renewable in the world that you could build. Anything you can build today that generates electricity, I think it'll be taken up. Doesn't matter what the source is. So the 2030 plans, they're not going to be delivered as proposed. But I think the buildup of renewables and that sort of transition to lower carbon emissions and whatnot, I think there's a trend that will continue. I don't see that changing.
So what do you think is the bigger opportunity? Is it in the base metals, or is it in energy? Like, I see what you're saying about the need. If AI is going to proliferate, if net zero is going to proliferate, the infrastructure and the stuff that's needed, it's going to center around that energy need. So where do you think is the best opportunity? Is it in the base metals, or is it in the energy sector?
To be honest, I see it everywhere. There are fantastic projects across all of these sectors, even PGMs that people have completely forgot about them. Like, I can't remember the last time somebody called me to talk to me about a PGM story. But PGMs are used in everything. You know, obviously, catalytic converters. They're also used in the hydrogen world. They also have precious metals type characteristics. If gold's running, you know, there should be some association there and some replacement. Demand replacement. I'm bullish almost everything. It's kind of shocking to say. The world needs these things. Obviously, I think we can almost everybody watching this this interview would agree with that. But the level at which there's been underinvestment in our industry over the last 20 years is astounding, and we're going to see. We're going to see, I want to go back to the original, that point that I mentioned before. We're going to see the market change very significantly in the sense that before you would find a project, you would build it, and then you would just sell the commodity based on a reference price. I think that's going to change. There's going to be government institutions involved providing financing. There's going to be lesser transparency on market terms, like you see in uranium, where there's long-term contracts from counterparty to counterparty. You're not relying on an LME futures price to price your product. And I think it's going to add a lot of dynamism to the market. And there's going to be opportunities for more players to insert themselves in different places across the supply chain and the value chain. And the opportunity is just so large. Like, we need more energy. We need more copper. We need more electrification. I don't know if you've seen this, but, you know, People used to travel on airplanes once a year to the Caribbean for a holiday, and now you go on Instagram and you see people are on holidays every other month. That's miles and miles, thousands and thousands of miles that we're flying. That takes a lot of energy, from building the airplane to actually powering the airplane. Our lifestyles demand a substantial amount of resources that we are not prepared to deliver. And that's the opportunity. I think that's why most of us are in this space. We just see this asymmetric blow to the upside. That's going to happen at some point. The timeline is uncertain, but you have to be here to be a participant when it does happen.
put yourself in the position of, let's say, a fairly new investor that's comfortable with resources, wants to invest, sees all the choice that you describe. What thoughts do you have on how they can narrow down into where to put their money? How do you make those decisions to kind of break it down? Because when you have so much choice, I think that becomes part of the problem. It either paralyzes you or you just get worked up. So how do you make those decisions?
Well, I would keep it simple. Investing is not too difficult a science. Stick to the basics: copper, gold, and oil. Those three have been around for a long time. They'll be around for a long time. Stick to known management teams. Find groups that have been successful in the past, and then track them. Work with them. We have so many repeat serial success people in our industry. You just find them and invest with them. See where they're putting their money and put it there. It's you can start there, and then as you start seeing how this game works, you start identifying opportunities. You start seeing patterns. You start learning how the market behaves. And you start identifying more asymmetric opportunities. But I think as a start, just find the serial success people. Keep it basic and simple. There's no need to overcomplicate it. Complication and return are not associated to one another. And try to learn as much as you can every day.
Right. Some final words on Olive Resource Capital. What can investors expect over 2024?
So at Olive, we have built a portfolio that we feel comfortable with now, thankfully in time for this moving gold. I don't want to make any predictions or promises, but I want to say that I am excited by the opportunity set in front of us from an investment landscape perspective. We are looking to grow our assets. We're looking at other opportunities to do that, acquisitions, launching products within Olive that acquire third party, that bring third party capital into the platform so that we can allocate cost in a more in a more effective way, so that it erodes less of the capital that we currently have. And from an investment horizon perspective, what I would say is Olive today trades at a 60% discount to its asset value. Now, picture you're a young person like me, and you buy the house of your dreams, and the bank tells you that you only have to pay 40 cents of every mortgage payment. That's the opportunity I see right now. So I take my salary and I blow half of it every month into the stock. It just seems so blatantly obvious to me. And now I'm comfortable because I know what we're doing. I know there's a long-term horizon here. I know we're trying to build wealth for the long term. We're conscious about risk. I had the opportunity of managing substantially larger amounts of money in a fund world that's much more structured. I had some exceptional mentors. I used Global and Galileo and other parts of life. And I think I'm ready to kind of build on that. And this is the vehicle that we've chosen to do it. It has outstanding characteristics in the sense of permanent capital. We don't have to meet redemptions, which means we can invest in a more patient, long-term way. And I think that's the secret sauce for compounding. And that's what we're looking forward to doing over the next couple of years, and hopefully much longer than that.
Excellent. Sam, it was great. Thank you very much for your time, and I'm looking forward to chatting with you again in the future.
Lots more to talk about, so anytime.
Thank you for listening to Mining Stock Education. Please subscribe and share this show with like-minded investors. Connect with us at miningstockeducation.com and sign up for our email list to stay in touch. Much success to you as you learn about, invest in, and profit from mining stocks.
The mining business is one that generates gigantic wealth. You know, a good drill hole that converts might cost $50,000 or $100,000, and it might discover something worth a couple billion.
There is no sector that I know of that has offered up as many predictable circumstances where there was the possibility, certainly not the certainty, but the possibility of 10-for-1 returns as there is in small cap and micro cap mining stocks. Concomitant with that, if you don't do the work, or even if you do the work and don't discipline yourself on the sell side, there are very few places in the world where you can lose as much money as quickly as in mining stocks too.
I just started to study up on mining stocks, and I just became fascinated because this is such a tiny sector and it's so volatile that either you could do really, really well, or you could pretty much get blown out of the water really quickly.
The mining sector is a very risky sector. It can take your money very, very quickly. Don't fall in love with stocks. Don't be overly confident. And just do your work as best you can. Do your very best. But don't fall in love and don't get too overly confident, because that's a recipe for disaster.
I have met, you know, professional retail investors that have made a tremendous amount of money on the junior mining space. Some of them aren't accredited, and they spend their days researching, talking to people, being on the phone, pouring through financial documents. But it requires commitment.
This podcast is for informational purposes only and is not to be considered personal legal or investment advice or a recommendation to buy or sell securities or any other product. We make every effort to be accurate, but the information presented is not to be considered infallible. It may contain errors, and we offer no inferred or explicit warranty. If personal advice is needed, consult a qualified legal, tax, or investment professional. Do not base any investment decision on the information contained on miningstockeducation.com, our podcasts, or videos. Make sure you always conduct your own thorough due diligence before investing. Realize that we may hold equity positions in or be compensated by some of the companies we feature, and therefore are biased and hold an obvious conflict of interest. For our full disclaimer, please visit our website.